Chapter 122. Little Julia sails without U.S. to make good the hint thrown out by the consul upon the conclusion of the farce of the affidavits. We were again brought before him within the time specified. It was the same thing over again. He got nothing out of us, and we were remanded, our resolute behavior annoying him prodigiously. What we observed led us to form the idea that, on first learning the state of affairs on board the Julia, Wilson must have addressed his invalid friend, the captain, something in the following style. Guy, my poor fellow, don't worry yourself now about those rascally sailors of yours. I'll dress them out for you, just leave it all to me, and set your mind at rest. But handcuffs and stocks, big looks, threats, dark hints, and depositions, had all gone for naught. Conscious that, as matters now stood, nothing serious could grow out of what had happened, and never dreaming that our being sent home for trial had ever been really thought of, we thoroughly understood Wilson, and laughed at him accordingly. Since leaving the Julia, we had caught no glimpse of Time 8, but we often heard of him. It seemed that he remained on board, keeping house in the cabin for himself and Viner, who, going to see him according to promise, was induced to remain a guest. These two cronies now at fine times, tapping the captain's quarter casks, playing cards on the transom, and giving balls of an evening to the ladies ashore. In short, they cut up so many queer capers that the missionaries complained of them to the consul, and Jermyn received a sharp reprimand. This so affected him that he still drank more freely than before, and one afternoon, when mellow as a grape, he took umbrage at a canoe full of natives, who, on being hailed from the deck to come aboard and show their papers, got frightened and paddled for the shore. Lowering a boat instantly, he equipped Wyman 2 and the Dane with a cutlass apiece, and seizing another himself, off they started in pursuit, the ship's ensign flying in the boat's stern. The alarmed islanders, beaching their canoe, with loud cries fled through the village, the mate after them, slashing his naked weapon to right and left. A crowd soon collected, and the Aroritani, or crazy stranger, was quickly taken before Wilson. Now, it so chanced that, in a native house hard by, the consul and Captain Guy were having a quiet game at cribbage by themselves, a decanter on the table standing sentry. The obstreperous German was brought in, and finding the two thus pleasantly occupied, it had a soothing effect upon him, and he insisted upon taking a hand at the cards, and a drink of the brandy. As the consul was nearly as tipsy as himself, and the captain dared not object for fear of giving offense, at it they went all three of them and made a night of it, the mate's delinquencies being summarily passed over, and his captors sent away. An incident worth relating grew out of this freak. There wandered about Papeete, at this time, a shriveled little fright of an Englishwoman, known among sailors as L.D. Mother Tot. From New Zealand to the Sandwich Islands, as he had been all over the South Seas, keeping a rude hut of entertainment for mariners, and supplying them with millimeters and dice. Upon the Missionary Islands, of course, such conduct was severely punishable, and at various places, Mother Tot's establishment had been shut up, and its proprietor made to quit in the first vessel that could be hired to land her elsewhere. But, with a perseverance invincible, wherever she went she always started afresh, and so became notorious everywhere. By some wicked spell of hers, a patient, one-eyed little cobbler followed her about, mending shoes for white men, doing the old woman's cooking, and bearing all her abuse without grumbling. Strange to relate, a battered Bible was seldom out of his sight, and whenever he had leisure, and his mistress's back was turned, he was forever poring over it. This pious propensity used to enrage the old crone past belief, and oftentimes she boxed his ears with the book, and tried to burn it. Mother Tot and her man Jose were, indeed, a curious pair. But to my story. A week or so after our arrival in the harbor, the old lady had once again been hunted down, and forced for the time, to abandon her nefarious calling. This was brought about chiefly by Wilson, who, for some reason unknown, had contracted the most violent hatred for her, which, on her part, was more than reciprocated. Well, passing, in the evening, where the consul and his party were making merry, she peeped through the bamboos of the house, and straightway resolved to gratify her spite. The night was very dark, and providing herself with a huge ship's lantern, which usually swung in her hut, she waited till they came forth. This happened about midnight, Wilson making his appearance, supported by two natives, holding him up by the arms. These three went first, and just as they got under a deep shade, a bright light was thrust within an inch of Wilson's nose. The old hag was kneeling before him, holding the lantern with uplifted hands. "Ha, ha, my fine counselor," she shrieked. "Ye persecute a lone old body like me for selling rum, do ye? And here ye are, carried home drunk, hoot, ye villain, I scorn ye." And she spat upon him. Terrified at the apparition, the poor natives, errant believers in ghosts, dropped the trembling consul, and fled in all directions. After giving full vent to her rage, Mother Tot hobbled away, and left the three revelers, to stagger home the best way they could. The day following our last interview with Wilson, we learned that Captain Guy had gone on board his vessel for the purpose of shipping a new crew. There was a round bounty offered, and a heavy bag of Spanish dollars, with the Julia's articles ready for signing, were laid on the capstan head. Now, there was no lack of idle sailors ashore, mostly beachcombers, who had formed themselves into an organized gang, headed by one Mac, a Scotchman, whom they styled the Commodore. By the laws of the fraternity, no member was allowed to ship on board a vessel, unless granted permission by the rest. In this way the gang controlled the port, all discharged seamen being forced to join them. To Mac and his men our story was well known. Indeed, they had several times called to see us, and of course, as sailors and congenial spirits, they were hard against Captain Guy. Deeming the matter important, they came in a body to the Calabooza, and wished to know whether, all things considered, we thought it best for any of them to join the Julia. Anxious to pack the ship off, as soon as possible, we answered, by all means. Some went so far as to laud the Julia to the skies as the best and fastest of ships. German, too, as a good fellow, and a sailor every inch, came in for his share of praise, and as for the captain, quiet man, he would never trouble anyone. In short, every inducement we could think of was presented, and Plash Jack ended by assuring the beachcombers solemnly that, now we were all well and hearty, nothing but a regard to principle prevented us from returning on board ourselves. The result was that a new crew was finally obtained, together with a steady New Englander for second mate, and three good wheelmen for harpooners. In part, what was wanting for the ship's larder was also supplied. And as far as could be done in a place like Tahiti, the damages the vessel had sustained were repaired. As for the Maori, the authorities refusing to let him be put ashore, he was carried to sea in irons, down in the hold. What eventually became of him we never heard. Ropey, poor Ropey, who a few days previous had fallen sick, was left ashore at the sailor hospital at Towner, a small place upon the beach between Papeete and Matavai. Here, some time after, he breathed his last. No one knew his complaint. He must have died of hard times. Several of us saw him interred in the sand, and I planted a rude post to mark his resting place. The cooper, and the rest who had remained aboard from the first, of course, composed part of the Julia's new crew. To account for the conduct, all along, of the consul and captain, in trying so hard to alter our purpose with respect to the ship, the following statement is all that is requisite. Beside an advance of from $15 to $25 demanded by every sailor shipping at Tahiti, an additional sum for each man so shipped as to be paid into the hands of the government, as a charge of the port. Besides this, the man with here and there an exception will only ship for one cruise, thus becoming entitled to a discharge before the vessel reaches home, which, in time, creates the necessity of obtaining other men at a similar cost. Now, the Julia's exchequer was at low water mark, or rather, it was quite empty, and to meet these expenses, a good part of what little oil there was aboard had to be sold for a song to a merchant of Papeete. It was Sunday in Tahiti and a glorious morning, when Captain Bob, waddling into the Calabooza, startled us by announcing, "H, my boy, shippy you, air makey sail." In other words, the Julia was off. The beach was quite near, and in this quarter altogether uninhabited. So down we ran, and, at cable's length, saw little Jewel gliding past topgallant sails hoisting, and a boy aloft with one leg thrown over the yard, loosing the fore royal. The decks were all life and commotion, the sailors on the forecastle singing, "Oh, cheerly men," as they catted the anchor, and the gallant Jenin, bareheaded as his wont, standing upon the bowsprit, and issuing his orders. By the man at the helm stood Captain Guy, very quiet and gentlemanly, and smoking a cigar. Soon the ship drew near the reef, and, altering her course, glided out through the break, and went on her way. Thus disappeared little Jewel, about 3 weeks, after entering the harbor, and nothing more have I ever heard of her. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.